Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And wow, has this not been an exciting season for the release of really important cookbooks by major chefs, and I might add thoughtful chefs as well.
So if California is the golden state, then our two guests for today's program are golden chefs or California superstars or whatever you like to call them. But first up in the program, David Kinch, an iconic individual with an iconic restaurant in the tiny community of Los Gatos, which is now almost subsumed in Silicon Valley, but David's producing wonderful things of a rather different nature. And, why don't we just do the story?
It's always very difficult for me to do an interview with a chef I'm in love with. You didn't know that, did you, David Kinch? I loved Eric Repair's introduction. He says he is organic, biodynamic, and sustainable, honest and conscientious, creative and committed, an inspirational peer, a great friend. And you know what? All those things are true. And beyond that, there is a mystery about you. Is I don't know where all this creativity comes from.
Oh, I wish I knew.
Well, don't you have a clue?
Well, creativity for me, I'm working in the kitchen. I'm inspired by many, many things. I'm inspired by other chefs, inspired by other restaurants. I'm inspired by travel, reading a book, not necessarily a cookbook, markets. Visiting markets in new cities.
Yeah, I love that too.
You experience new sensations, sight, smell, that sort of thing, and it's all new. And when you see new things like that, you become really aware. At least I do. I become a heightened sense of awareness that I think become reference points when it comes time to create new dishes.
Now, you feel an affinity for the land, but particularly for the ocean as well. I guess I left out that you were also a gardener and a surfer. I think those things come into play here. For people who don't know, Manresa is in Los Gatos, California.
That's correct.
It's a little bit of Eden there, isn't it?
It actually used to be known as the Valley of the Eden Valley because of the orchards that used to be Silicon Valley. Was the perfect place for stone fruits, peaches, cherries, apricots, walnuts, almonds. The weather condition was absolutely perfect. And it was this land that became Silicon Valley. And you still see the holdouts, little patches of where you'll find a cherry orchard or an apricot orchard in the middle of all the technology that's here. And even then, the fruit is stunning. It's a great reminder of what the valley used to be.
Well, you know, I asked you before we started this recording is how to approach a book that is, first of all, it's enormously personal. Since I know you, although I don't know you, like, intimately, but I know enough about you and have interacted with you somewhat to know that this book is a really honest representation of what you think. And it's you, this book. And how... And it's philosophy. You are, again, I mean, there's a whole new category of chefs that I call philosopher chefs, but you're a thinking chef as well as a creative chef. How to approach talking about this book and describing to listeners what it is. And you suggested to talk a little bit about how you organize the book because the whole thing was meant to represent who you are, what Manresa is. Let's get into that. Manresa, first of all, is how old now?
It'll be 12 years old in July of 2014.
And you said by this date in your history with this restaurant, you're really able to put something down on paper because it took you a long time to write this first book.
Well, we waited a long time. The actual process of writing, the physical process of writing took us about 15, 16 months. And we were pretty well organized, but I think it's interesting. Nowadays, with the new media and the way ideas and restaurants and chefs are promoted. I think coming out with a cookbook early on, you know, the first year, year and a half that a chef becomes known or restaurants open up, is kind of the established trajectory for a chef, to get their name out there, to get recipes out there. But we didn't want it to be that kind of book. We didn't want it to be just a collection of recipes representing us. I think part of the Man Racy experience and coming to us is hopefully the richness of the ambience and the experience, the patina of being open 12 years shows through. And we wanted that to be a part of the book too. This book could not have been written 10 years ago. I don't think it could have been written 5 years ago. As I say at the beginning of the book, Man Racy was just a restaurant, hopefully a good one, but everything changed once the relationship started with Love Apple Farms. And I think that's where the story really takes off.
Yeah, chapter one is called How I Met Cynthia Sandberg, and this is probably one of the most amazing aspects of the restaurant. Tell us about your relationship with Love Apple Farm.
Well, I met Cynthia back in 2005. She was a champion tomato grower. She was an attorney who grew tomatoes on the side, and we met by chance. She was eating at the restaurant, and I knew she grew tomatoes. And she brought some of the best tasting tomatoes that I had ever had. And so she supplied the restaurant for about a year. And at this time, I was flirting around with the idea of starting a small garden to produce things for the restaurant, to start to grow our vegetables for the restaurant. And somewhat naively, I should probably add, you know, as if I didn't have enough time to do everything else. So I approached my farming and gardening acquaintances and friends, asking them how I should check out land and that sort of thing. And when I approached Cynthia, her first response to me was, well, I should be this person doing this for you. So she, you know, we made commitments to each other. It became her full-time job. We worked hand in hand. We made commitments to each other. And just like the restaurant, she started small and she started to grow. And we've grown together. And, of course, the big changes were about 2-3 years ago for both of us, in which we did a major renovation at the restaurant. She changed her location. She moved from just shy of 3 acres in one location to 22 acres. Mm-hmm. So she moved from garden to farm.
Yes.
And it changed everything. It's a whole different ballgame now with diversity and quality of the product coming to us.
Is she still in the Santa Cruz Mountains where the old gardens were, David? Because we visited there, and it was an amazing experience. To imagine 22 acres, that's quite a lot of land. Is it still in the same general vicinity?
In the same general vicinity, about 15 minutes away from the old location. It's a different microclimate, but
yes.
it's closer to the restaurant.
Now, is she also adding animals?
We have about 120 laying hens, and we currently have goats right now that are producing milk that we use for, we make our own cheese and yogurt and that sort of thing at the restaurant.
I still want her ice plant. Seeds for
it. It's still there.
And how about those 9-foot-tall heirloom tomato plants? I couldn't believe them when I saw them. Tell me this. You say that it determines this garden, what's produced that day, and should we throw in that it's biodynamic as well? So at any given moment, you could be found with the steer horns and the manure, right?
Yeah, those are processes that's part of the language of biodynamics. You know, Cynthia's got a full team now. I know I participated in a lot of that at the older space, but the newer space is much more organized and efficient because it's so big. But yes, they do still work with those practices. Yeah.
But basically what I set out to say is that whatever she produces really determines what you're going to produce then in your kitchen.
Yes, it's a major source of inspiration about what we use. You know, there's not a lot of surprises. We work, for instance, last week we just planned our summer of 2014, the crops that were going to go in. Together we look at seed catalogs, we talk about our successes and failures, what we're bored with, perhaps new products we want to try, things that we like, do we want to grow more of? Things we didn't like but still want to use, do we want to grow less of? All these kind of questions. We try to plan and anticipate as much as we possibly can to make all of our jobs much easier. And, of course, one of the things with working with an exclusive producer like this, it's important that we be as – we do not do any waste at all. We try to have the least amount of waste that we possibly can. And
Ariane, I think that's
part of being respectful.
Uh-huh. Ariane Duggan has that all those
it's called the Green Circle,
the
right?
The Green Circle, yeah, going in New York with all the scraps from Per Se feeding her chickens.
Yes.
Now, tell me about Chapter 2. Why was this an homage to an egg?
Well, that dish was a dish, you know, is a dish that really resonated with me on many different levels as a professional cook, both the flavor and by what it represented. So much so that it's a dish that we serve at the restaurant in honor of its effect on me.
You said it was perfect.
It's a perfect dish. I do. I think it's one of the, you know, perfection is very rare and it probably doesn't exist, but it's as close to perfect as I can imagine. And, of course, I'm speaking personally, but, you know, it's a personal book. That's why it's in there.
Now, tell us a little bit more about that. You've teased us now. Anne's already read the book. I didn't read this particular page, but listeners won't have done that. So what is the recipe and what makes it so perfect?
Well, first of all, it's the presentation. You know, an egg is a perfect shape. You know, it's a single cellular structure. It's the start of life. The color is white, so it's a perfect serving vessel. And the egg has both sweet, salt, sour, bitter, umami elements. It's got hot and cold. And when it's served early in a meal or as the first course, it is such a refined and elegant, understated explosion of these flavors and temperatures in one small bite. To me, that's what makes it so perfect.
And the next chapter you move into is an edible reflection, which basically is your subtitle of the book. Now, is that your wording?
Yes, it is.
So what did you mean by it?
It means what we're trying to create at the restaurant is a reflection, is a gastronomic reflection of not only who we are at Manresa, but where we are, a reflection of the sense of place, of being in the foothills of the Santa Cruz Mountains on the central coast of California, where the mountains meet the sea.
And while we're talking about that, let's do your signature dish about Into the Garden.
Yes.
Now, we had that. We had that, yes, I believe.
Into the Vegetable Garden is the one dish that remains on the menu. But ironically, it's also the dish that changes every day because it's a deceptively simple-looking dish that is reflective of all the produce and items that are available from Love Apple on that day or on the plate. The rules are if it's from Love Apple, it has to be on the plate. And if it's not from Love Apple, it can't be on the plate.
And you made your edible dirt?
Yep.
And you have different textures. I mean, I've been to lots of restaurants where they have edible dirt, and then they stick some root vegetables in, cut short. That's not this.
Well, this is different. It's a personal dish.
It is. I mean, it certainly is. Do you want to say anything more about it?
Well, it's pretty much in the book. You know, the dish developed over time, but now we want it to be very much. That dish is the edible reflection. It's it represents our relationship with Love Apple Farms and where we are and what we're trying to be.
I might say, at least mention, that the photographs are absolutely outstanding in this book.
Eric Wolfinger.
Oh, they're just, they're edible too. you take off on little riffs on things like a section on your butter. I mean, how did you decide on what to focus on like that?
In what way?
I mean, you pull out of all the stuff you're talking about your butter and what makes it special?
Well, the butter, I think, you know, the butter is one of the things we're most proud of what we do. I think we have a great cream and milk source, and dairy is one of those things that's very representative of seasonality, even more than vegetables, I think. You know, milk and cream from unique sources vary widely in flavor, just, you know, weeks apart. You know, rainfall effects, the dryness of grass affects the flavor of milk. For me, I've found that, you know, the little butter making that I do at the restaurant is incredibly rewarding, but also a great window into the variation of the seasons. And that's why that's in there.
Yep. And you also pull out the concept of your salt and how it comes about.
Yeah, that's a fun little project. You know, it started out just to see if it would work, and it worked in spades. It's a lot of fun to gather it. It's easy to make. All you need is a little bit of time. And I think it adds a certain specialness to the things that we do at the restaurant.
There are certain particular items that reappear. You seem to be madly in love with nasturtiums.
I go through my phases.
So we've already talked about the Pacific as muse, right?
Yes.
And building a dish. Now, I read this, but I'm not sure I actually got how I would go from reading this to actually building a dish the way you do. I read your chapter on building a dish.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure that from the way you explain it that I would have that, what do you call that word, the nerve endings connect synopsis or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Mine aren't the same as yours. I wouldn't come out with a dish doing what you did, building a dish.
Oh, well, I mean, I guess it's just practice. It's a system that, you know, I've become, you know, that works for me. You know, I'm only speaking for myself.
David, I think it's called genius. I don't think it's just experience.
I think the older you get and the longer you're in the business and the more you see, the more reference points and data points you have that you can reach back on. That aids things. So, genius is a funny word. I like to think of it as hard work and respect for products and having a great team at the restaurant. You know, people that all share the vision that we have and want to be a part of it.
Didn't somebody once say that genius is 1% inspiration and 99% perspiration?
Yes, it is. It's 99% hard work. I agree with that.
Can you give us an example of a dish you created through this process?
Almost all of them.
Yeah, almost all of them, okay.
How about suckling kid goat confit with curds and whey?
Well, curds and whey was the what happened was. I mean, the kid goat is from, a goat cheese. A goat cheese farm where we get our goat's milk and goat cheese from. And what we did is, you know, the connection there was curds and whey. You know, it's, you know, everyone's heard the expression curds and whey. And we put the kid goat with it because the goat was from the same source of where the milk was coming from. So that's an easy one.
And it's called Little Miss Muffet's Special Goat.
There you go.
Here you have, the listeners, be prepared for, from his inspiration, a lot of surprises. These just jump out off the page at me, David. I mean, turnips and radishes, all spiced tangelo with savory granola.
Yeah, that's the tangelo is easy. That's just it's an heirloom variety coming from the source that we talked about in the book, Mr. Gene Lester.
Yes.
So it could be any citrus fruit that has a little bit of sweetness to it. But the savory granola is a project that we've been working on, and not only does it appear on that dish, but we use the savory granola almost all the time. It's in some shape or form on the menu. We use it with shellfish, we use it with meats, we use it with vegetables, we use it with fruit. It's just something that we really like.
Now, you're not into a lot of gadgetry. You use a sort of modern equipment when it's easier or it comes naturally and to help you do whatever you're doing, but you're not a gadget nut.
No, I'm not. I mean, I use a lot of, I don't rule out anything without trying something. Something needs to work for me. I use a lot of modern techniques. Mm-hmm. I use some modern ingredients, that sort of thing. But my rule of thumb is that you don't see it. You know, it's not like an advert. Look at me. Look at this technique. That's not what I want my end to be. My end is a plate of food that is beautiful to look at and delicious to eat.
Well, I admire that. Massimo Bottura does that too. I know he's moved past the technique. I mean the gadgetry stage. I have to mention you have nasturtium macaroons that are so pretty I can't believe them. They're just gorgeous. Now, when we're talking about this equipment, I think we ought to mention audience for this book. You point out right in the beginning that not all these recipes are going to be accessible to your average home cook. And that's not the point, right? What is the point? Point out that not everybody, it's not your daily go-to cookbook. I mean, it's
no,
and you're not going to be able to make all these. The average home cook is not going to be able to make all of these things. And in fact, your average home cook won't have some of the equipment that you need.
We didn't want to, you know, I didn't want to dumb down the recipes. I wanted the recipes to be a truthful indication of how we worked at the restaurant and what we did at the restaurant. Now, there are some simpler recipes. There are recipes that are much more approachable. And there are recipes with much more ambition. And these are recipes that if people feel a little bit more comfortable after mastering some of the simple recipes and want to try something more complicated, we encourage them to do so. Because that's exactly how we work at the restaurants. We're always trying to better ourselves, to get better and to improve ourselves. That's what home cooks should be doing also. Cooking is one of those endeavors where the more you learn about it and the better you get, the more you appreciate it and the more joy and pleasure you get out of it. Isn't that true?
Yeah. I mean, I love, absolutely love reading this book. Most of all, though, I'd like to come to your restaurant and eat the food when you already cooked it.
Now, here's a question, David. You just talked about the recipes being out of reach, possibly from a technique and an equipment standpoint, but they're also a little bit out of reach when it comes to the availability of ingredients, which is so central to what you've been doing at Manresa since you were connected up with Love Apple Farms. But is there an approach that is reflected in your restaurant in the ingredients that you have available to you that people can do on a smaller scale when they have access to a lot fewer ingredients?
Well, I mean, cooking is all about ingredients and seasonality. It's very simple. I'm not, because I use something and because I'm based in California, that doesn't mean people should be flying in stuff to make a dish or anything like that. I mean, it's the concept of what we do is working with what we have and making something tasty and delicious from it, you know, and you can do that anywhere. You can do that anywhere, but you have to work with the products at hand.
So let's suppose now we're into the season of plastic tomatoes. We've been in the season of plastic tomatoes for 3 or 4 months already in Pennsylvania. You're not.
Yeah, but I wouldn't even use them. Why use them?
So what do you do instead? Is there some?
I don't use tomatoes.
Okay, you do, but what do you put on a plate that might be similar? Is there anything similar to that, or you just?
Well, right now I work with mostly brassicas and cabbages and root vegetables. I mean, I don't even think about tomatoes. I only use tomatoes that come from Love Apple Farms, and they don't get ripe until July 1st. I use tomatoes from July 1st to October 1st, and that's the only time of the year I do. And there's never a time where I say, gosh, I wish I had a tomato to put on this dish right now, out of season.
Yeah, you just tuned it out. You just tuned it out, right? You said your time will come next July.
Well, yeah, of course. By the time, and you know what? You use tomatoes. You use them in almost everything when they're in season. And then by October 1st, when the season's ending, you're pretty much sick of them anyway, and you don't want to see them for 9 more months.
Here's a dish that you say is representative of the Manresa style: assorted potatoes, soft and crispy, with curds and whey and nori nod. Could you explain why this is representative and talk a little bit about how this goes together as a dish?
Well, the potatoes are from Love Apple Farm. It's a vegetarian dish. The potatoes are from Love Apple Farm. The milk is from that same source, the curds and whey source. So we make the fresh cheese that are in that dish, and we use the buttermilk and the whey from the production of the cheese, as part of the Sauv. The Nori Nod is, it's a funny name, but what it is, it's actually an idea I got from a farmer's market in France one day. And basically what it is, it's like a tapenade. It looks like a tapenade, except it's not made with olives. It's made with nori seaweed. And that's pretty much it. You know, it's got everything. It's vegetable-centric. It's based on a product from Love Apple Farms. It's based on a dairy product that's local in which we manipulate, in which we take the raw product and we create other products, a fresh cheese and whey. And the Nori Nod is something that's unique and different that we have come up with because of our inspiration, you know, a market in our travels.
Well, all in all, I just think that people to really appreciate Manresa, you can look at this book and you can drool over all the photographs and read the recipes, but I guess more and more people are finding their way to Las Gatas, California, David, and we're going to have to do that again soon. You have other sections in this book. You have your bar program. You have call outs with producers and with other chefs in the restaurant. It's a full and personal portrait of a restaurant, I think.
I have one last question, David.
Yes.
Were you satisfied when it was done?
Yes, very much so.
I think
it didn't turn out exactly how I thought it would. It turned out better. I'm very happy with it. I think it's an honest portrayal. I don't pretend to speak for anybody else. I don't want to say what is right or what is wrong, but I wanted to say what has worked for us and what we have found over time. And I wanted people to get a good idea of what our restaurant was about and the experience that we offer to our guests.
And I think you've done that.
Yeah, I think you did it brilliantly, just as you cooked for us brilliantly when we were there, and you'll cook for us brilliantly the next time we come back. All I can say, listeners, if you're in love with food, you just got to have this book, and you got to read it from cover to cover.
David Kinch.
Thank you.
Manresa, An Edible Reflection. David Kinch, we love you dearly. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
See you soon.
Okay. And email me anytime. And you're always welcome out here. Just let us know when you're out this way.
Thank you so much, David.
My pleasure, sir.
David,
Happy New Year to you both.
Yeah, Happy New Year to you, too. Thanks,
okay.
David.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And don't go away, because we'll be right back.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
And here we are again. It's really extraordinary when you look around at the talent we've got in these United States in terms of chefs, as well as a lot of other things. But today's program, I think, it's pretty startling to see the amount of not only talent, but also intelligence and writing ability. Next up, we've got Chef Daniel Patterson, who can write as well as he can cook, and it's just an amazing combination of talents. Let's listen to Daniel. We've had some difficulties because we're all so busy setting up this interview, but I'm so happy to finally be talking to you, Daniel Patterson, about Qua, your wonderful new cookbook, produced by Fiden, which, I mean, I think they really turn up marvelous testaments to the talent of the chef, I think. And it's called subtitled Stories and Recipes, which indeed it is. I wanted to start off a little bit off kilter, is I thought it was really interesting when you were doing your book tour that one of the few joint dinners you did was with Gabrielle Hamilton of Prune in New York City, simply because both of you have in common the fact you're not only brilliant chefs, but also brilliant, naturally gifted writers. Was that a deliberate move?
Well, first of all, thanks so much for having me on your program. Actually, I didn't cook with Gabrielle. We did a talk together.
Right.
And it was about food writing,
okay,
basically. And we talked a lot about cooking and about restaurants as well.
But, yeah, it was very, Gabrielle is a good friend, is someone who I admire a lot, and so it was very natural, sort of pairing.
What tilted you towards cooking as opposed to writing? Because, I mean, you write so brilliantly.
Gosh, that's a good question. Well, I started cooking when I was pretty young, when I was 14, and, I guess, writing was something that I did when I was in high school. It was something I was very interested in. But at the same time, I left college to cook, and I decided I want to make that my career, and I didn't really get to writing until I was in my mid-30s. So I basically didn't write anything for about 15 years. I mean, except prep lists.
Oh, okay.
Now, you also transitioned from East Coast to West Coast, am I remembering correctly?
Yeah, that's right.
Which is interesting, because you sort of epitomize the whole concept of and the spirit of California cuisine and the West Coast.
Yeah, it's ironic, isn't it? But
it
then
is.
Again, if you think about it, I mean, Alice Waters is from New Jersey, and David Kinch is from New Orleans.
New Orleans,
and,
yeah.
You know, I mean, if you look at, actually, you know, Wolfgang Puck is from Austria. So California is a state of immigrants. So it makes sense that immigrants would basically define its cuisine as well.
It's also a state that has such a wonderful wonderful food basket. I was going to say laundry basket. I don't know why. it's such a wonderful larder for just about every kind of food you can imagine.
Yeah, it's really incredible. What we have to work with here in the middle of winter is better than a lot of people have to work with, like, in the middle of summer. So, I mean, sure. I feel very fortunate. And also the farmers, the ranchers, they care a lot. They work very hard. We're very lucky to be working with a group of people who are producing the food, who are very passionate and very talented, and that makes our job a lot more, not just a lot easier, but a lot more fun.
Now, you are, by definition, an ingredient-focused chef, so you're in the right place, that's for sure. You very early came to this plant-centric position, too. Aren't you marveling at how the whole shift of everybody in that direction is happening now?
I think it's great. You know, I think that the only way that the planet is really going to be able to feed all of the people on it is by changing our diet towards what it was traditionally for thousands of years, which is meat as a condiment, as part of a larger, more complex meal, rather than as the whole meal. And so the way that we've been eating in America for the last couple hundred years really is not reasonable. It's not sustainable. So I think it's great that the chefs are starting to move towards a more plant-based approach, because what that means is that when people go to the restaurants and they have something, the way you convey ideas, if you're a chef, is through deliciousness. So if you go and you have a plant-based meal and it's delicious, it makes you start thinking, wow, I can have this at home. It's maybe something I can do more of, because it tastes really good. I mean, if it doesn't taste good, then you're not going to crave it.
Yeah, you talk a lot about deliciousness. I mean, it's a very personal thing.
It's very personal, and at the same time, I think, you know, if you're a cook, it's the most important thing. It's like, you know, if you're an artist, you want to make something beautiful. You know, what defines beauty is of course, you know, going to be personal, but I don't think many people set out to make ugly art that no one wants to see. I don't think many cooks set out to make food that no one wants to eat. So I think that, you know,
sometimes you wonder.
Well,
you can sometimes wonder, really.
Well, we all succeed to a greater or lesser extent, but that's really the focus of our kitchen is to make the food taste as good as possible.
You know, when we started this conversation, I told you that when I first got this book, I was so excited. I read it page by page and took notes as though I were in a course in college back again, you know. And now I don't understand my notes, to be perfectly honest. But I do remember thinking about how thoughtful you are on every single aspect of cooking. I mean, you give probably the best explanation of balance that I've ever read. Yeah, I mean, seasoning, managing acidity, balance, salt. I keep trying to explain that. When I was writing regular columns, I kept trying to explain it. I could never explain it the way you explain it. So explain to our listeners what you think about this maintaining balance in your flavoring and seasoning.
Yeah, I mean, balance is a great subject. I think, you know, it's not just food, but wine they talk about a lot too, and it's a very difficult concept to explain. It means that basically an essential harmony between things that are solid and things that are liquid, things that are rich and things that are bright and acidic, that somehow there's a center and that everything revolves around this center. So the way that I would talk about balance is different depending on the situation. But in our kitchen, it's a word that comes up every day. And I guess it was easy to explain it in the book because it's part of our normal conversation. So, for example, there's a charred onion broth in there, which is just charred onions that have been chopped and simmered with water.
Right.
It's kind of smoky and sweet. We add vinegar and salt at the end. That's it. There's only basically two ingredients, you know, three if you count water. But if you don't cook it enough, if you don't get enough extraction of sweetness, the vinegar is tinny and unpleasant. And if it's too sweet and too reduced, it gets almost syrupy and you don't feel the vinegar. The whole thing feels leaden. So the balance within the sauce, the sweetness becomes the ballast for the acidity, leaves the acidity on top and gives a sense of freshness to go with the kind of round, roasty flavors. And that whole thing sits underneath new olive oil. And its whole purpose is to create a sauce on top of which the new olive oil rests. So balance happens within a sauce, but then it also happens within the larger context of a whole dish.
Well, if everyone could master that, we wouldn't have to worry about any mistakes.
fortunately, I think it's for any cook, it's a lifetime kind of learning, you know, to understand how to approach every situation with that same sensibility.
Yeah, and you seem to encourage taking risks to make mistakes so that you can then overcome those mistakes and do it right the next time or time after that,
Yeah, I mean, risk-taking is really important in our cooking because if we don't risk, we don't learn. Mm-hmm. And we're interested in doing things that are difficult, that haven't been done before. And I think in order to do that, then you have to fail sometimes. You have to accept some failure as part of the process. Because if you only do things that you can do well, then you're not really challenging yourself or charting any new territory.
Now, how much do you practice? I mean, you have an 11-course tasting menu. You change it probably almost every day.
No, not at all. We change it maybe about once a month now. Now okay. We change the whole menu all at once. It depends on the season and all kinds of things, but if we changed the whole menu every day, we'd have no consistency.
Oh, I see. Okay. Now, a lot of chefs seem to be saying, I go to the market and that's what's on today's menu.
Hell no. We know what's in people's fields. We know whole stretches of product availability.
Right.
So we know everything pretty inside out, and so we know when something's going to be around for 2 months. And a dish gets better and better the more a cook practices it. So if you only put it on the menu once, you know, it's only going to be at 50% of its, you know, its possibility.
Well, that's what I was thinking. And so you've answered my question. In fact, you do get to practice.
There's another part of that. We practice before it even goes on the menu quite a bit.
Oh, sure. I'm sure you do. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, the process is very important in your kitchen, isn't it? You're very precise.
Yes, we try to be. And no matter how much we practice before it goes on a menu, we always have to work very hard once it goes on the menu to make it even better. And then, you know, by the time we feel like we've perfected it, it's time to change the menu. But the nice thing is then we're constantly building our repertoire and we're always getting these dishes that we can go back to.
And the nice thing about it is you can read all about them in this book. So even after they're off the menu, you can retaste them by reading how you describe them.
This leads us to discussion. Explain how you organized this book, Daniel.
So basically there's an introduction that says who I am and how I got to have this restaurant in the first place, because I figured, you know, most people wouldn't know who I am. There's a second part, which is just about the kitchen and the equipment we use, the techniques, and some of the underlying philosophies. And then we do one menu, so an 11-course menu, which actually, with a few extra things, ends up being about 15 dishes. And that's to look at it as if you were in a restaurant, looking at the food from the seated position, dish after dish after dish. And then we organize the rest of it by year, so from 2006 to 2012. And then each dish has an essay and also a recipe. The written recipe is more conversational, so it's not like step one, step two, step three, but kind of like how I would talk to a cook. And then there are ratios. The ratios are in the back, but they do work.
But you don't mean this to be a book that people come home from work and pick up to see what they're going to cook for dinner.
Probably not. But there's parts of the book that could definitely find a place in the home kitchen. There's a dandelion nettle salsa verde, which would be good in everything from chicken to pasta. There's, you know, a recipe for a soup, a sunchoke soup that, you know, could apply to any kind of root vegetable. And it's just basically three ingredients, brown butter, vegetable stock, and the sunchoke. And you just cook it until it's tender and blend it. So there are some things that would be applicable, but I figure if it's easy to recreate a two Michelin star restaurant at home, you're probably doing something wrong.
Right. Well, you know, when I interviewed Gabrielle Hamilton after her memoir, I guess it is, autobiography, as a writer myself, I can't imagine ever revealing that much about myself, and you reveal quite a bit about yourself personally. In this book too, but Gabrielle said, but you know, she didn't reveal absolutely everything, and I'm sure that you held back at a certain point too.
Oh well, yeah, quite a bit. But I think one thing that both Gabrielle and I have in common, which is that we're very interested in honesty, and I think that if you're not able to be forthcoming, then you're not going to be able to be very honest. So, and that was something that was very important about the book. I wanted to be very honest and to talk about the things that worked, the things that didn't work. Cooking is a very human thing, and I wanted to portray it in a human way.
I, for some reason, on my crazy illegible notes, wrote lime marshmallow with big stars around it. Do you have any idea why?
No idea. So that's a dish. The frozen marshmallow is a technique that Matt Tinder, our pastry chef, adapted from another chef and turned into a dish that had basically a mixture of lime juice and a very high gelatin ratio marshmallow, and it's frozen and then spun in a Paco jet. So it's basically like a frozen, very acidic marshmallow. He put a layer of lime-scented meringue on the outside and burned it with a piece of charcoal. So it's kind of a childhood memory dish, kind of a taste memory when you're growing up and you're toasting marshmallows over an open fire, but, you know, with a little bit of a twist because, you know, it's got this bright lime acidity. So it kind of sits in between the meat course and the desserts.
Well, yeah, I see where it sits on the overall menu here. What are some of your favorites out of this book that people should be looking for?
Oh, gosh, that's a great question. I can't say that I still love all of the dishes in there because I put a few in just from kind of more historical purposes. But by and large, like, you know, I look at all the dishes and I still love them. And there's the one I talked about with the new olive oil and the charred onion broth with some grilled brassica and a dandelion potato puree. That's on the menu right now. So that's something that we've done every year for a couple of years now. It's just a delicious dish. It's deceptively time-consuming when we do it at the restaurant, but very easy to understand. So for right now in the middle of winter, it's a great dish.
Now, remember I asked you about texture. I just found what I picked it up from. It says, after seasoning, texture is the most important element of our cooking. It's the delivery mechanism for flavor. That's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, so controlling texture is about controlling the way that you perceive flavor to a large degree. If you think about it, a broth is very evanescent. It disappears quickly, whereas if something's thick, it stays on your tongue. And so controlling that viscosity allows you to control the way that you perceive the flavor for a shorter time, a longer time. And so it's a very important element in that regard. And then also we work with a really diverse palette of texture as well as flavor. I think traditional American palates tend to be not very diverse in terms of how they perceive texture versus a lot of older cultures like Asian cultures, which will have things that are gooey and things that are, you know, sticky and different levels of crunchiness. And so for me, like, texture is a very, very interesting part of what makes a dish fun to eat and what makes it distinctive.
Your list of ingredients is interesting. I don't think if any average person did a list of ingredients that come up even close to what you have listed.
Probably not.
Starting with abalone.
You know, I do it for a living, you know. That's my job, so it should be interesting, you know.
Yeah, do you find these things, or do people bring them to you, or is it kind of like a mixture of that? I mean, you do seem to have some rather obscure ingredients.
Yeah, a little of both. All of the wild stuff I find myself, but a lot of the cultivated stuff, I mean, it's grown by farms, and, we buy them at markets or direct from the farm, or some things I grow myself. And in my house, I have a garden, so that allows me to grow certain kinds of herbs that are very distinctive, but really impossible to find in the open market.
Give me a favorite herb that's not in that category.
Well, for example, the Roman mint that's on the carrots roasted in coffee beans, tiny little leaves and then in season flowers, and with this really explosive kind of wild flavor.
I envy you your access to seaweeds, by the way. That's one of my favorite things in the world.
Yes, indeed.
And you have essential oils, vinegars. Again, you always have that, do you call it a high note of the acid, the vinegar, the lemon?
Yeah, again, you know, it's kind of balance. It gives energy and a liveliness to the dishes that we look for. Without it, dishes taste kind of flat. But again, it's about creating balance. The ingredients that we work with here often are very sweet, so they need acidity to balance them.
Now, you have how many restaurants now?
Four.
Four
plus a bar.
But the only one that's multi-course and complicated is Qua, right?
Yes, although
the new one.
Our chef at Plum, Kim Walter, does the tasting menu as well. So she has an a la carte menu and a tasting menu.
Yeah, I noticed that she's going to be cooking at the James Beard House coming up pretty soon.
Yes, and she is a very, very exciting cook. I would highly recommend checking her out if you get a chance.
She's arriving too.
How old is she? Is she under 30?
33.
Oh, see.
Yeah, so still pretty young, but great experience, technically very sound, extremely creative, great palate. Yeah, just a really exciting chef.
Now, that's the second one. That's Plum. Now, the other two, let's make sure we get them into this recording so that...
Yeah, so we have Haven, which is also in Oakland. The chef is Chris Johnson, who worked with me at Qual for a couple years. And that's very solid, approachable, but interesting California food, some Mediterranean influence. And then we have Alta, which is European and Eastern European, and that's the new one. And the chef, Yoni Levy, another great chef. I'm very lucky to work with a lot of fantastic people. And Yoni makes food that is kind of everyday food, but just a little bit better.
Well, I can tell you that just talking to you makes me wish I were back there having another meal at Qua. And I'm not sure that I'm going to tackle these recipes at all. Which one do you think I might tackle?
Oh, gosh. guess whichever you're in the mood for.
Oh, yes. And we mentioned that you do travel, and you enjoy experiencing other chefs and what they're interested in and what they're doing. And where are you going next?
Let's see. Next, I'll be doing a dinner at in Milan, the Bulgari Hotel, in January.
Really? Okay, we can't go in January.
And then I'm cooking in Bangkok with Pascal Barbeau in March.
Yeah, well, when is the 50 Best Asian?
Oh, you know, that's a great question. I have no idea.
They didn't know either, the 50 Best people. Did
the last time we communicated with them, they didn't know.
I don't know.
And maybe they're not going to have one.
I don't know,
we need the London date in the worst kind of way.
Yeah, well.
So I can plan our adventures around that. Now, if you're not dining in San Francisco, where do you like to dine?
All kinds of places. I mean, I eat in Oakland a lot because I live in Oakland. I like Charlie Halliwell's places, Pizziolo and Boot and Shoe. I have two kids, so I usually go to a place that's a little bit more kid-friendly in San Francisco. I like Outerlands, which is Brett Cooper, who used to work here, very, very talented. There's Nopa, Nopalito. So many places.
Well, there's so many places. There's no shortage of wonderful places to dine, so we're all very lucky. And we're lucky to have you, Daniel, and your thoughtfulness about food. I'm so thrilled that I have this whole raft.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, I have this whole raft of philosopher thinking chefs that I can talk to now. I love it.
Well, it's a pleasure speaking with you.
Yes. And good luck in your new restaurant and continued success with your other restaurants.
And to you as well. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Dan. Ciao.
Okay, take care. Bye.
Isn't it amazing what two soft-spoken guys, really, really very introverted and shy in a lot of ways, have achieved so much. And we're so grateful to them for sharing their message with us in today's program. And we hope you enjoyed it as much as we did in talking to these two guys, David and Daniel. And that's all until next week, when we'll be doing some more good stuff from these United States. So don't forget to join us then, and we'll look forward to it together with you. Bye for now.
Bye-bye.